Do you know what the sad part is, Odo? I'm a very good tailor.
Garrick, I was thinking that you and I should have breakfast together sometime.
Why, a constable? I thought you didn't eat.
I don't.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, hailing Admiral Todman.
And we're here this week to rank the Deep Space Nine two-parters.
Cam, I think we kind of neglected to do this one months and months ago. We got a little bit caught up with, say, Star Trek Discovery, which is want to happen when you've got a brand new series on air. And then we got carried away with continuing on our Star Trek Voyager two-parters.
Yeah.
And we...
Picard news, all that sort of stuff, yeah.
But this was a fun episode when we did the analog for Star Trek Next Generation. We ranked all those two-parters and got into a lot of fun stuff there. And
I was shocked. I actually re-listened to that episode just to remind myself how we kind of formatted these types of episodes. To see how far back that episode was, it was like 107 or something like that.
Oh, wow.
I was like, oh my God, is that how long ago we finished TNG two-parters?
Like 2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
Dear Lord. Well then.
Time is the fire in which we burn.
So I'll just tell you this. Broadly speaking, I had fun going through this list and just figuring out that there's maybe some two-parters within the canon that maybe some fans overlook and others that maybe they overrate to a certain degree. But I don't know. I think we'll have some fun with the way that we're going to rank these. Tell us, though, Cam, what is kind of the format for this episode?
Well, we're going to count down from 10 to 1, go through and break down, you know, why we chose what episode for what placement. Then at the end, we'll recite our list so you guys at home have an idea as to what our actual lists were, because sometimes that gets lost in the translation when you're just talking back and forth about episodes. And then we're going to give out awards for, you know, some topics like best action sequences, best performances, things like that. You know, just kind of a fun, you know, sum up of the whole experience of going through these DS9 two-parters.
Okay, well, why don't you take it away with number 10, sir, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, so number 10...
And this is your particular ranking, number 10, and then we'll jump over to mine in just a moment.
And I really did realize, you know, not so much with the TNG. This wasn't the case with TNG. I found with DS9, there's like no terrible two-parter.
Yeah, I agree.
Like TNG, there was a few we really got to make fun of. And with these, I'm like, huh, okay, well, I kind of like most of them. And so my number 10 is The McKee. It's an episode that, like, I don't dislike in any real way. I think it has some good stuff in it. You know, you get the Quark arms deal stuff. You get some really great Gul Dukat. But ultimately, like, this is the introduction of the McKee, who obviously play a huge role in ongoing Star Trek canon from that point forward. It wasn't, like, a big, exciting introduction of this group. You had that Cal Hudson character, that friend of Sisko's, that was just kind of left unresolved at the end of the episode. It was kind of like a bunch of good ideas that just weren't baked to the full potential. Like, imagine if they did this McKee episode in, like, season 5. Mm-hmm. It would have been incredible. Mm-hmm. But at this point, they're still experimenting with the form of what DS9 is. And this one's, you know, it's fine.
So for me, I'll jump ahead. This is my number 10 as well. And the reason why it was is there were fewer memorable moments in this than any other one in my list. And that's where I really struggled. This one just did not stick in my brain as much. And like you said, maybe it's probably the Gul Dukat stuff. And I think it's when Cal Hudson vaporizes his own uniform on a table. Those are maybe the two most memorable things for me.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
When you sat down to make your list, did you remember that much of what happened in this episode?
No.
Me neither. Yeah. I had to go back and read Memory Alpha.
So did I.
Like, what the hell? Like, we didn't watch it that long ago.
No, but look,
you know what I remember the most was the scene of Gul Dukat with his armor was broken and it's like hanging open.
I think you and I made a lot of fun of that particular moment on our original review of it a couple years back. So.
Yeah.
What do you think this is with regards to, I guess, mythology making for the Maquis?
Well, I mean... It's obviously setting them up as these, you know, this kind of opposite of the Federation. But I don't know that it ever did a very good job in Star Trek in general. And we see them obviously on TNG as well with the direction of Ro. The McKee were never portrayed as that compelling to me. And I think they were maybe a couple passes away of nailing down this group as something really compelling. And I just don't think they ever got there.
For me, though, they did work as soon as they kind of introduced the Eddington factor, though. And I think that's the problem. Did they really have a face on it?
Well, they did with Cal Hudson.
But they never really maintained that. And that's kind of the issue. Once you have Eddington, who's kind of a recurring character, I like how he goes from like this like wallflower to like this Sisko's greatest nemesis. You know,
those are the perks of being a wallflower.
Yeah. So, I think DS9 did way more interesting things with the McKee than, say, Voyager did. They really built a mythology there. And I truly did enjoy some of those, you know, McKee episodes, if you know what I'm saying.
Do you think it would have been a better idea to have had like a character, whether it's Eddington or a character like Eddington, that had been built up at least in a few episodes, who then shifts into this position running the McKee, versus like a Cal Hudson, who, like, really good actor playing the role, but he shows up as a guest spot and you're like, well, I guess this character is going to do something.
I mean, I understand why they did that, because they wanted to have somebody who had a previous history with Ben. But maybe, honestly, they could have done that with what you're proposing, though. Like, have that character who's more in the background, who had that history with Ben. I know, man. It should have been Jadzia Dax the whole time. So
I feel like a later two-parter would have done that.
Yeah. No, you know, for sure.
Especially with DS9.
And this was season 2, I believe.
Yeah.
So it was still early. They're still finding their feet.
Exactly. There, so. This is like the season of If Wishes Were Horses. So you know what? This was a home run in that season.
Yeah, no kidding. So, Cam, why don't we do the snake draw? And so you started with your 10. I'll jump over to my 9, and then we'll go back and forth kind of like that. So my number 9 was Homefront Paradise Lost. There.
Okay.
This one, again, I think back to who the main antagonist is. Again, it's one of those bad apple admirals, but it's a lower rank, but that doesn't mean there's not great, fantastic stuff going on in this one.
Yeah.
I just think back to the Changeling O'Brien interaction with Ben Sisko. It took Ben way too many beats to realize that it was, in fact, a changeling.
Yeah.
But I think kind of the build up of paranoia going on Earth was an intriguing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't know if this is, if you think about all the epic episodes of Deep Space Nine, I don't know if this is necessarily the most epic of two-parters, despite, you know, a lot of the fun stuff we had going back to Earth, kind of seeing Ben on Earth getting the new, or I should say the old uniform on. You know, there's some cool things. His interactions back at Sisko's, his family restaurants, you know. And so by me ranking at number 9, I don't think this is a bad episode at all. It's just maybe fewer of those outstanding moments that I got in other two-parters that we'll be discussing. What do you think about this two-parter here?
Yeah, it's one I feel similarly as you. It's an episode that bites off a lot, and I don't know that it's ever able to pay off as much as it wants to. You know, you have this whole, like, martial law, and then it's like three guys on a corner.
Yeah.
And you're like, I mean, okay.
It's 1990s syndication budgets, you know. I can give him a pass on those.
It's just like the incredibly convoluted, what was it? The, like, Leighton disrupting, like, the electrical panel through the people in Red Squad.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God.
We did get the introduction of Red Squad here. So that was a little fun. But to me, when you think about the climax is whether or not the USS Lakota is actually going to destroy the Defiant.
Yeah.
And I don't quite understand that. The Defiant was built to be this powerful battleship that could take on the Borg, and you've got this 100-year-old Excelsior class just giving it its all.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I don't know if I kind of felt all that tension there.
I remember we reviewed this two-parter with Patrick Johnston, and we all kind of felt like, boy, this is like an episode or a two-parter with great ideas, like really, really fantastic ideas for sci-fi. And it's just not quite taken that extra step to be really great.
Yeah, for me, when we're ranking these, I want to think of them all within a vacuum and not thinking about what comes after there. But I can't help but think that maybe everything that they set up here with regards to the changeling paranoia, it never really quite paid off. Like, were there, I mean, unless you were all that concerned about, you know, Gowron being a, or Martok being a changeling, who could it be?
Yeah.
You know, beyond that, though, I think there are a lot more opportunities to get a lot more paranoia a-brewing throughout the rest of DS9's run.
I think it suffers a little bit with Leighton, too, who's just not the most, compelling or charismatic antagonist.
Yeah.
So
Cam, that was my number 9. Let's go to your number 9.
Yeah, my number 9, again, two-parter I really like, but I, think ultimately I have to put it further down, and that's Past Tense.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, this is the story, that's, at the time, when I first saw this two-parter, I didn't like it really at all.
Yeah, I felt the same way, but...
But it's one that, when we rewatched it and reviewed it, it was something like, wow, this episode is really ahead of its time, and its themes about homelessness and...
Just kind of like the widening gap in income of, between the haves and the have-nots within society. You and I were both really kind of blown away by how applicable this episode made, 20, 25 years ago is to today. Like, it seemed like such a Star Trek episode, whereas DS9 always went a little bit against the grain, and this seemed like more of a classic Star Trek episode.
Yeah, exactly. And it's one that, the first time I saw it, I really just looked at it from the point of view of, like, the Gabriel Bell riots. And coming out of it, I was like, I don't really know if the Gabriel Bell riots were really that big a deal in Star Trek, considering no one's ever mentioned them before.
Well.
And then revisiting it, I kind of realized I really had the wrong attitude when I watched it the first time in criticizing it for that versus seeing what the larger social commentary was. And it's an episode I really much appreciate. But I must say, when I'm looking at my top 10, and the reason this one did rank quite low... It's not one I really want to throw on that much. I can really appreciate what they did. I like that they gave it a showcase in the new DS9 documentary, What We Left Behind.
Yeah.
But I can't say, like, if I'm like, boy, I really feel like watching some Star Trek, I'm going to throw on Past Tense.
Were you surprised that one was given its showcase
in the documentary?
Yes. Yeah. As much as you and I actually, we appreciate this one.
Yeah.
It just wasn't the one that I think sticks out to fans all that much, though. And I wish, fans would give it a more of a rewatch. But I think that's what the problem is. I don't think it actually calls for that much of a rewatch. But I think if fans did it with an open mind, they'd appreciate so much of what's going on here. Too much of the time, I just wonder if they get kind of bogged down with that really lame Jadzia Dax potential love interest who really, really digs her. And she could not give a crap about this guy, but it's hilarious to watch.
He is like a vapor. Like, I have no memory of that character, only that we made fun of him a lot.
I cannot picture what he looks like other than bland white male.
Yeah.
But we had a blast making fun of that dud.
Yeah. I was going to try and do some more of that, but I'm just like, I would have to rewatch Past Tense to be able to do that because I have no memory of this man.
Yeah. I still like all the jokes that we got about everybody thinking that they're walking around in their pajamas.
Yeah.
And Jadzia calling her comm badge a brooch.
Yeah.
But look, I like seeing O'Brien and Kira giving the peace sign to some hippies see them transport down to Earth. There's a lot of fun stuff going on in a otherwise pretty heavy episode.
I think that's maybe part of the problem with a lot of fans, too, is that when Star Trek does time travel, usually it's really fun.
Sure.
And this was not a fun time travel episode.
It was a heavy one.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so Cam, we're doing the snake draw, which means you go from your number 9 to your number 8.
Yeah, my number 8 was Homefront and Paradise Lost.
So, okay, we're kind of in lockstep so far.
Yeah, I think we have similar feelings about that one, where it just felt like when I look at a lot of the two-parters that DS9 does that are going to rank higher on my list, they took similarly very ambitious ideas and delivered it. And I felt like Homefront and Paradise Lost just didn't. And the same way you said, like, you never really feel this great threat on Earth. It just never quite sells. It feels like, again, all the pieces were there, but it just doesn't have that magic that comes across. So it's like a functional two-parter, but it's not one that I really hold in high regard at all.
Do you think it benefits at all from a little bit of retconning that we got later on when they told us that that's when Odo was introduced to the changeling disease by Section 31?
It definitely gives it a little more importance
that
I don't think it had beforehand.
So tell me, why does this one in particular go just above Past Tense for you?
I think it was because when I was going through just looking at like the elements of it, I just liked the ambition and its impact on the overall storytelling of DS9. And like when I'm looking at like the characters and the changelings and just the foundation of the mythology, it just has that extra little bit of detail to it that I appreciate and enjoy. Like that's what I watch DS9 for ultimately. Like, Past Tense is, I think, a more maybe interesting social commentary episode. But again, like, I would probably rewatch Homefront and Paradise Lost again over Past Tense because of the sense that it does fold into the larger mythology. And I feel like that story does sort of contribute something.
Okay. So, Cam, now it's my turn for my number eight.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we're in lockstep. Mine is past tense, parts one and two. I just thought that just because there's a little bit of a heavier story going on, like I thought it had a little bit more gravity to it than, mm-hmm. say, what we got from Homefront and Paradise Lost. So
I really did bounce them back and forth quite a few times.
Look, I mean, it's like... maybe you're giving one an 8.5 and the other an 8.4.
Exactly.
You know, so what can you do there? So I mean, we're so far pretty much in lockstep. So why don't we jump over to my number seven now? And I think this is where we're going to dive deeper into kind of the big showcase two-parters that fans typically really jump to when they think of DS9 two-parters. So again, I'm not saying this is like a bad one, even though it's on like the bottom half of my list here, but I put In Purgatory Shadow and By Inferno's Light here at my number seven. This, of course, is where we discover that Bashir has been a changeling. We get to be introduced to, say, Martok, the real Martok, that is, as Worf goes to a battle to the death with all those Jem'Hadar. There's a lot of very memorable stuff here, mm-hmm. going on. And it really kind of stokes what is going to inevitably lead to the Dominion invasion of the Alpha Quadrant.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I really like this whole story. The whole prison concept is fantastic. Again, it was a really cool idea that they came up with and really pulled off fantastically well with, you know, syndicated TV budget.
Holy moly. Yeah. You know, like, just even cool stuff with, like, say, Garak in like a cramped quarters, yes. on an asteroid.
Great,
you know,
character stuff.
You know, and we got also, again, the return of one Paul Doolin, mm-hmm. playing Garak's mentor. Why am I blanking on this fella's name?
Oh, Tane.
Tane, Enebrin, yeah. Tane. Yeah, yeah, you know, and like just their back and forth. They always had great chemistry, which I really dug into.
Plus, Worf taking on all those Jem'Hadar. Yeah. One of the most badass Worf moments of all time.
One of the less badass moments was, I guess, the demise of the Bashir changeling, where he kind of, like, let himself die to a certain degree by letting this bomb go off that was being carried aboard the runabout as he was...
being, like, the Defiant, like, drags him away and he blows up. They basically toss him.
But I didn't even understand what his plan was. Like, he was going to drive the runabout into Bajor's sun. And make it go supernova.
Yes.
He's going to sacrifice himself.
Yes.
For the good of the great Link,
I guess. Yeah. To me, like, that is the one misstep of this two-parter, is, like, the stuff with Changeling Bashir at the end is kind of weak, but it is a fantastic story. Like, I really, really love this one.
Do you think there's maybe, beyond that, what's maybe one of the weaker points in this one, though? Is anything that stand out? Because to me, I mean, it's a pretty strong.
It is.
You know,
honestly, it's
all
just
the
Changeling Bashir finale, I think, is the only part of it that I would, you know, have some issues with.
I just find it kind of surprising that maybe that you've got all this great buildup, and that's kind of where it climaxes.
Yeah,
just kind of like.
Well, it's like they felt like they needed some sort of action climax to all this, because the prison stuff is kind of, you know, a little bit depressing and a little bit heavy. But you don't necessarily need, like, this Bashir, you know, action sequence.
I've got it for you. Better climax, prison riot, where the rioters just go after the Jem'Hadar. They see what Worf can do. They figure they can do it as well.
And, or it just turns into the movie Chicago.
I'd love that. Who would be leading the dance numbers?
Well, I mean, obviously Worf.
Okay.
But who's singing Mr. Cellophane?
I think it'd have to be Martok, right? Yeah. So. All right. So, Cam, that was my number seven. So why don't we go to your number seven?
My number seven was Emissary.
Oh, okay.
Which is the pilot for DS9. I really enjoyed this the second time we watched it. I did not really enjoy it the first time I saw it.
So what was it, the difference for you? Or maybe let's start with the first time you watched this. Why did this not work for you?
I think it was the fact that it was completely disorienting to watch the first time. Like, I didn't have a huge foundation in Berman-era Star Trek. I'd seen, you know, a handful of episodes of TNG, like, I don't know, two decades or a decade plus beforehand. But I was much more familiar with the original series. And when I got thrown into this one, I was just kind of like, okay. And I did like the character introduction stuff where we're meeting Kira, O'Brien, all that sort of stuff. But when we got into all
the
stuff.
We're meeting O'Brien?
Well,
I think he
the
got,
DS9 equivalent, you know.
For got me, about 100 episodes of introduction.
Tyler, for me, I was meeting O'Brien.
Oh, yeah, that's
for the
true,
most
that's
part.
True. Fair enough. I apologize.
I'm sure I'd seen him, but I can't say I remembered him that well from TNG.
You remembered his voice going, aye, aye, Captain, a lot from the transporter room onto the bridge.
I knew him more from Con Air than Star Trek at that point. But, I mean, I remember the first time feeling like I really got bogged down with the wormhole alien stuff. This is a story, though, that I think is so much better when you've watched the series. Going back and watching this pilot, I was actually really amazed when we watched a while back with Mike Hager was the guest on that one. And just how it is very like self-contained story about like time and how we perceive time and Sisko having to overcome his own, you know, problems to be basically the, you know, the person that DS9 needs going forward. I really, really like this story.
It was definitely one of the more science fiction-y stories that we ever got from Deep Space Nine, which leaned a lot more towards, say, the character drama than the high concept stuff that we've gotten, say, the later seasons of Voyager.
Yeah.
For me, though, this one, if we think about pilots, this one does pretty much everything a pilot should.
It does.
Think about the introduction with the Battle of Wolf 359.
Yeah.
You have the emotional stakes established very early on with this man having to care for his child as a single parent. And you establish, and this really rocked the boat quite a bit, but you establish Ben Sisko as a character in opposition to Picard.
Yeah.
You wanted to make sure that this is not going to be a Picard clone moving forward. I don't know if it's the best way to introduce a character who's like bashing in a beloved character, if like, that's your main star.
One of the most beloved characters, if not the most beloved character
We're
of all time.
Literally getting a Star Trek Picard spinoff come this fall.
Who's the character they should have put in Picard's place that we would accept, you know, Sisko bashing?
Barkley. Just Tucko punching down. Yeah. Could you imagine him like ripping Barkley a new one?
That would be amazing.
Yeah. But look, I think it's still, we can question the execution. I still think it's a really good idea about what you should be doing with regards to introducing kind of a new series. They were making it clear this is not going to be a copy of TNG. And I think that's a genius thing. Look, the introduction of all these characters.
Is there a single one they really go wrong on? No. We can argue about maybe Bashir's portrayal in the first couple seasons, but the way they introduce the character is totally in keeping with what they want to do.
But even just how they introduce, say, someone like Dax, and they kind of explain it in an easy-to-digest, no pun intended, flashback, you know? So it's just that sort of stuff that I think is just like this is a very, very strong pilot, so...
Kyle Paca?
Another fan favorite, of
That's
course.
Right.
But this one, like, I did like it much more than you did the first time that I saw it, and I would agree with you, my appreciation of it grows even stronger however many more times I've seen it. So for me, this is a very, very strong two-part episode
it's
of Deep Space Nine.
It's not an encounter at Farpoint, where when you look at the bookends between the beginning and the end, you kind of go like, well, All Good Things is really head and shoulders above that premiere.
Yeah.
And when we look at What You Leave Behind, like it doesn't feel like a bookending that is, you know, really, really inconsistent in terms of quality. Like you go like, you know what, these two really do stand fairly side by side.
Biggest regret though is the prophets were not name dropping the fire caves in Emissary.
I know
that would have brought it up full circle.
I know.
Me. So Cam, that was your number seven. Let's go to your number six.
My number six is Improbable Cause and the Die is Cast.
Interesting.
The introduction of Tane, obviously, and the setup of the Obsidian Order. And I really love this two-parter because this is really delving into the character of Garak in a way that is going to be very important going forward. We establish Tane as this mentor / potential father figure, question mark. And I love the relationship between these guys. I love the idea of the Obsidian Order. And it's just giving these shades of gray that DS9 is really going to dance in for the next, you know, handful of seasons.
I prefer TNG's shades of gray.
Riker wasn't dancing, Tyler. That leg wouldn't let him.
What a stupid injury to get, Riker. Like, seriously.
But, I mean, this whole two-parter is just fantastic stuff, especially the scenes between Garak and Odo, where we see Odo being tortured and Garak just trying to get him to give the information. And it's tough to watch, to see, like, Odo, a beloved character, a character who does nothing but give off vulnerability. So, like, the fans love him because he's such a vulnerable character. And to just see him being broken down by Garak and Obsidian Order is just brutal stuff.
Was there a character on Deep Space Nine that Rene Bergeron did not have, like, just awesome chemistry with? Like, I just think about, like, all his scenes with, say, Kira, for example, with Garak, with Golda Kot as well. They may be few and far between. But even when he was, like, lecturing Jake and Nog... And, of course, the Quark and Odo stuff. I just think that maybe Rene Bergeron is one of the more, you know, unsung heroes of the series.
Yeah.
And I think it's maybe no surprise that the mythology of the series builds around him more and more. Because I think the writers knew that they could put a lot on his shoulders and he'd be delivering all that. And I think this is a two-parter that totally shows what this man can do from an acting standpoint, you know, just watching him rot away and how it actually pains Garrick to do that. But like, the thing is, the parallels between those two characters, all they want is to go home.
Yes.
And they're at odds about it. It's just kind of a fascinating episode to watch.
It also reveals like the moral code of Garrick, where like he's a character who in many ways could be portrayed just as like villainous as like Tane or something like that. But you see that there is that little bit, just that tiny glimmer of like a conscience. Like he's made friends with some of these people and he actually does care. Not as much as maybe the more morally upright characters of Deep Space Nine would, but that's what ultimately like redeems this character and why he's not a Gul Dukat or something, like a villain.
Yeah, so you're saying that Garrick is like Varys and Gul Dukat is like Littlefinger. Right, Cam?
Completely. That's exactly. It's like you just read my mind.
For all those out there, Cam's never watched Game of Thrones. He has no idea what this means.
I was like, is that a Deadwood reference or something? Like,
no. To me, a fantastic two-parter. However, my number six is, in fact, The Search.
Okay.
Parts one and two, the season three premiere. I think this is a genius way, not necessarily to reset the series, but to give it a bit of a new life. You are introducing the Defiant. You are introducing the Dominion for real this time, as opposed to kind of just the foot soldiers, the Jem'Hadar that we met and the Vorta that we met in the previous episode, the season two finale called the Jem'Hadar.
Which many could have, you know, be forgiven for thinking, well, those characters will probably not really come back that much.
Yeah, but bam, they have a mission statement with a premiere like this one. I think The Search parts one and two is a great one. I think what lowers it in my ranking, though, is the plot twist.
Right.
And that's, I remembered the plot twist as I watched this one. And so as I was watching it all play out, I just kind of shrugged my shoulders quite a bit.
Yeah.
And instead, what I was left with was the stuff that mattered was Odo debating near a changeling pool. with Salome Jen's character. So
yeah.
I don't want to take away from this episode because, again, I think what we're pointing to, though, is like so much of the mythology of Deep Space Nine rests on Odo, and a lot of it comes down to these two-parters. I think we're kind of finding out that at a certain point they realize, hey, if we've got two-part episodes, let's make it about the Dominion and let's go big. And there's some great action sequences as we see what the Defiant can do as it gets started. There's also maybe some lost threads there with the whole Martha Hackett Romulan character, who's the engineer behind the cloaking device, and never saw her ever again.
Yeah.
And the Romulans were just A-OK with giving a cloaking device over to the Starfleet for some reason. For you, where does this rank, but what do you think of an episode like Search Parts 1 and 2?
I think The Search, you know, is really important. You mentioned it right up front. You said mission statement. And I think that's something we talked about when we reviewed this one, and that this really did feel like the show saying, this is what we are going to be going forward. This is the type of show we are. And it was actually a show that was really compelling. Like, imagine if the mission statement episode had been something really lousy.
Yeah.
You know, like, imagine if it was the equivalent of, like, Birthright.
Well, sure. One I'll point to, and I'm not saying this is a lousy one, but I think the season two, three-part premiere, The Siege, The Circle, and Homecoming, I think they wanted to make that a mission statement. And I just don't know if Bajoran politics was all that compelling to most viewers. And I like the Bajoran politics episode. I'll never vouch for the idea that it's worth a three-parter, though.
Right. Yeah, I know. I think that's fair. When we gave out the award for should this have been a three-parter?
Well, you know, one thing that we did not say off the top of the show is we're only covering like feature-length episodes or two-part episodes.
Yeah.
And the rule that we have for two-parters, though, is it must say to be continued at the end of the episode. So you might think that we left out some, but by our own rules, we did not.
Mm-hmm.
Because these are our rules and we made them up.
Exactly.
So, so that was my number six. My number five, we just discussed this, Improbable Cause, the die is cast.
Yeah.
And I just think that maybe that the performances of one Andrew Robinson and Renee Bergeron just elevates this one above what we're going with The Search Parts 1 and 2. And I'll just say that I think it was a more consistent two-parter than The Search Parts 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. Not to say The Search... I would say that The Search Part 1 was stronger than The Search Part 2, mostly owing to that plot twist that I don't want to spoil for listeners in case you haven't seen it for a while. But not to say that Part 2 of The Search is not worth watching again, but I just think that the Garrick Odo stuff is just brings it over the top for me.
Right, right. Okay, so my number 5 is In Purgatory's Shadow and By Inferno's Light.
So you definitely have it much higher up than I did.
I
so
do.
We are starting to diverge. You know? So tell me what makes this one such an epic showcase in your eyes.
For me, it's just the whole prison setting. Like, to me, this is such a fascinating, compelling story. When I think back, and that's what I did a lot of when I was making this list, was sit back, you know, read each title and think about that episode. Think about the moments, like which ones really hit you, which ones had big, you know, impact on you. And for me, this was the one I just kept coming back to in my head going like, I really love this two-parter. A lot of it has to do with Garrick. And when I was actually comparing it against Improbable Cause and The Die Is Cast, I'm like, which of the Garrick stories is the one that I really like, you know, more? I think that like Improbable Cause and Die Is Cast is super, super important to the Garrick character. But there's something about this whole plot line with him having to tunnel through to escape this prison that is just fantastic stuff. It's very Great Escape. And just to see that vulnerability in Garrick is just really compelling. And Andy Robinson, who I believe is claustrophobic in real life as well, I believe he has said that.
They really made him go method for this episode.
No kidding. Yeah. No kidding. But you can feel it in the performance. Like sometimes when you see a clunkier Star Trek episode, pick your series, and they make a character go through something like grueling, it doesn't quite come across. And I feel like it really does here. But in addition, you get great stuff with like Martok hanging out with, or I guess meeting them for the first time in many cases, these characters, because we had the Changeling one previous to that. And instantly, Hertzler feels like a character you want to see way more of.
Unlike when he played the Vulcan captain in Emissary.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
They weren't bringing that character back.
Yeah.
He could have been like a Borg drone in Voyager, right?
I don't know. Oh, there's so many. Yeah, imagine if that Vulcan captain had just kept going. That was his character through the run of the series.
Wow.
But no, like for me, that was ultimately it. Like maybe it's also that like when I think of the two-parter, the form of the two-parter, I want like a big splashy story that justifies why we are watching this for 2 hours. And when you look at the TNG ones, you know, like The Best of Both Worlds or even Time Zero, you're like, that's the one where they go to, you know, back to San Francisco. Like it feels like these kind of standalone epic stories, even if they do tie into a mythology. When I compared like Improbable Cause, well, I love that it's the Obsidian Order story, but it doesn't feel like this big standalone kind of cool, ambitious idea that they really want to take on versus like this whole prison story. And so that's why I put that one a little bit ahead, was it just feels like they looked at the two-parter form and said, let's do something bigger than we normally would ever do.
Okay. So we're getting down to business here. What is your number 4, Cam?
My number 4 was The Search. And yeah, like it's funny, you know, you talked about how watching it the second time, you were like, oh yeah, I remember this twist. And meanwhile, I was sitting there dumbfounded, like, I don't, oh my God, what's going to happen next?
I saw you. You were clapping like a seal the whole time.
Yeah.
I was like, Andre, calm yourself.
That's twice it suckered me. So, you know, this is an episode that could have just felt like table setting and been really kind of dull to sit through.
Sure.
You know, just like setting up, oh, okay, this is the Dominion. Oh, sure, the female changeling. Okay, I guess that's a character I need to care about. And yet, all the pieces really click and you actually do care about them through the actual story. It's not like, you know, the premiere does a little bit, you know, introduces characters sometimes and then you're like, well, maybe I'll care about them later. Versus like this one's introducing like the female changeling. You instantly find her unsettling. You find this character weirdly magnetic and someone you can't wait to see explored more right off the initial appearance.
Yeah.
And to me, that tells me it really did its job. And also the whole idea of Odo searching for his people. We saw that a lot in season 1 and 2 of DS9.
Well, I finally understand what the name of the episode means now.
But, you know, we saw him doing that a lot. And you can think of so many shows where a character is searching for something through seasons or a relationship is being teased for seasons. And when it does pay off, you're like, I mean, I guess it just wasn't as good as it, you know, you'd think. But Odo finding these people became iconic, just that moment of them coming out of the Great Link and Odo standing there. And it really had a huge impact on me. Like, it had majorly iconic imagery.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I cared about it as I was watching it. Like, I remember watching this one and being excited to, like, get into the next episode because it just was sucking me in so much.
Much like Odo is sucked into the Great Link there.
That's right.
Okay, so my number four now. People might think it's a little high, but I disagree with anybody who thinks that because I think The Emissary does everything that a pilot should do. It introduces the universe. It introduces the setting, the characters. It introduces one of the most compelling villains, if not the most compelling villain that Star Trek's ever had, with one Golda Kot, who is more thought of... He was just going to be a bit of a one-off sort of character for that episode there. Even just the way that it starts off with one of the most epic action sequences in all of Star Trek, depicting the Battle of Wolf 359, getting Patrick Stewart involved in your premiere.
Yeah.
Not so bad, you know?
Wasn't this like a super expensive episode too?
I think at the time it may have been the most expensive pilot ever produced for any TV series, period.
Was it more expensive than any of the other DS9 episodes?
I have to believe so because they would have included all the construction costs and all the sets.
Yeah, okay.
So,
right.
Yes. And I believe this is like a very expensive episode at the time.
Right.
So, look, I would just urge anybody who thinks I'm a little nutty for this pick, go back and watch it and think about what a pilot is. And this, I don't think it's actually Star Trek's best pilot. I think you and I rewatched Caretaker a few years back. And, we think that might be the strongest Star Trek pilot yet, regardless of what you may feel of Star Trek Voyager up to this point.
Yeah.
But I think Emissary is a very, very close second here. And I just think that it is worth just maybe a second look from a lot of Star Trek fans out there.
Yeah. It's definitely an episode that really grows on you. Like, when you actually go back and watch it as a fan of Deep Space Nine, it delivers all the stuff you hope for from Deep Space Nine. You know, having been to the end. Whereas, like, sometimes when you go back and watch some of the other early episodes of Deep Space Nine, you're like, yep, the show had a long way to go.
Would you say this one grows on you like a rock grows on Kira in Change of Heart?
I kind of like that episode.
Oh, sorry, Heart of Stone, rather.
Yeah, Heart of Stone, yeah. I like that episode, but yeah, it's probably a little better than that one.
Okay. Cam, my number three... We are in the nitty-gritty top three, sir.
I think it's interesting that I think we're maybe a different order, but we definitely agreed on what the three were.
Yeah. I'm curious what your number one will be, but we'll get there soon enough. I am very confident about my number one, but my number three, though, is Favor the Bold, Sacrifice of Angels.
Okay.
This, to me, is just so much build-up throughout that first part, Favor the Bold. And I think our one criticism, though, is that Favor the Bold doesn't really stand as its own episode.
Sure.
All it is setup.
Yeah.
But guess what? The payoff in Sacrifice of Angels is so good that I can forget all about that and just be mesmerized by everything from the action to the character drama to just how much we can kind of sympathize with a monster like Golda Kot, which is just amazing. And that last shot of Golda Kot just handing over the baseball to Sisko, it was just one of the most poetic images that we got in Berman-era Star Trek. Was not necessarily known for its poetic direction, and I just
not unless Data was reciting it.
Ode to Spot was my favorite, from those. This one, I just remember watching it as it aired back in the mid 90s and seeing that battle sequence realized.
Yeah,
I'd never seen anything like that on Star Trek. I never thought Star Trek was capable of doing such a grand sequence like that, and to me, it works. One other thing that maybe wasn't in its favor, and Iris Stephen Bear disagrees with fans like me who believe this, but I thought it was a little silly, the resolution to it, in that the prophets just say, okay, we're going to stop all the Jem'Hadar ships from coming through, and they made them all poof, disappear.
Yeah.
And they're like, huh. Okay, well, you know, I mean, I liked what they were doing with the cloaking mines and all the... Just even think about, like, the Rom stuff going on. Like, he was going to be executed, and Quark becomes a hero.
Well, but Quark, you know, shoots down those guards or whatever at the prison, but you see how that impacts Quark as well. Like, there's ramifications for the characters in even the, you know, the quote-unquote moments that would be badass. in like a different franchise or a different, you know, film series or whatever.
What do you think this does for maybe the memory of Xial? Like, she was a bit of a polarizing character. They had to hire three different actresses to play her. They never quite nailed the character.
Yeah.
But I think they started to figure it out, but she just...
Art school.
I don't know. It's just...
Figure it out, Tyler?
She just came off as so unbelievably naive, you know, but it's still, I can understand why her death at the hands of Damar, had such an impact on Dakot. The man was left with nothing at that point.
Yeah. Well, like, a character is never going to be worthless when they feature in one of the most powerful dramatic scenes in the entire series, which is, like, Dukat finding her after she's been shot. Like, that is just huge, huge, jaw-dropping stuff. Like, that episode is just... It's incredible. Like, it really is. And to me, like, the only reason to pull this one maybe a little bit down in a list is just a sense of, like, is this a two-parter? Because it does feel kind of like a seven-parter, and these are just the last two parts of it.
Yeah, but...
You know what I mean?
By our rules, where it says to be continued at the end, we kind of have to consider it. But I agree with you. This is more kind of the conclusion to a seven-parter that we got here, starting with the season five finale. Mm-hmm. So, look, Cam, your number three. What is it?
My number three was What You Leave Behind, which, one of the all-time great finales for Star Trek series across the board. I really do love this finale.
It's got a lot of stiff competition there, Cam.
What's the second? Well, we're going to rank them at some point down the road, so I'm not going to say, but there's a couple, I think, good ones, aren't there? Yeah, there is. There damn well is one that's great.
There's one.
Yeah.
Name more. Think about it. I'm just saying.
I heard they're really planning a fantastic finale for the Picard spinoff. So,
Can't wait.
At any rate, the reason, like, What You Leave Behind delivers so many unforgettable moments. You know, the big one, of course, is Odo going back into the Great Link tuxedo. But just all the goodbyes. Like, this episode will make me tear up pretty much every time. All of the resolution of the Dominion War is fantastic. You know, where we find the characters going at the end, like Garak, and all these supporting Martok, where Worf's going at the end. We get to find out each of the journeys these characters are going to go on, and none of them are unsatisfying. Mm-hmm. There's, like, not one where I'm like, I don't agree with that at all, which happens a lot with finales. Yeah. You know, finales are tough to write.
What was the most satisfying character conclusion for you in this one? What maybe made the most sense for where we started with the character and where that character ended?
I think Kira's is definitely up there. Mm-hmm. That, well, you know, so much features in that final shot of her standing out, looking out over, you know, through the window with Jake, right? But, you know, Kira's a character who has such, like, a convoluted relationship through the series and, like, trying to find her place, right? She's a character who was a terrorist. She's not really that comfortable with herself out of the gate. And we see how family changes her and how belonging to something positive really does bring out the very best in her and what she could be going forward. And so in the end, when we see her just looking out the window, you really get the sense that she's really stepped into this role of just looking out over her people on Bajor. Like, she actually is going to be the guardian because Sisko isn't needed anymore. You know, the story of where Sisko goes, maybe that's not the most satisfying for some fans. I know that I think some people are like, well, I would like to know what happened with him. But ultimately, he's not needed. Kira has kind of learned through her experiences and through her friendships that she can play that role.
She's the corporeal sort of, you know, caretaker at this point.
Yeah.
Opposed to the more non-linear Sisko at this point.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll make a pitch for this one. Just think about where Worf started when we were introduced to what was pretty much a glorified background player on TNG.
Yeah.
And he turns into this diplomat, and nothing seemed to be so fitting for a character, though. Like, where we just see where his journey took him over all these years. And it really only kicked into gear, if I have to be honest, in season four of Deep Space Nine when he was introduced to the franchise again. Like, I think iconic Worf equals, you know, TNG uniform. Mm-hmm. The best Worf equals DS9, though. And I just love where they left the character. Quite bummed out how they kind of did away with all of that development by the time we got to Nemesis and never really explained it. And, you know, so what can I say?
Yeah. The one thing, you know, that, well, there's a couple of quibbles I have with this one. One of them is actually tied to Worf, which is we get this great moment at the end of all the characters remembering all their moments on DS9, and, like, Worf's, it's like no clips of Jadzia.
Yeah.
And it just is like, that really sucks. And also, and we've talked about this plenty of times, but the whole Paw Wraith wrap up with, you know, Dukat in the fire caves, it feels so just tossed off. Like, where Sisko's like, uh-oh, gotta go do that quickly. And it's over in like a minute and a half or something. It just, it feels like an afterthought.
I still love how we literally watched Dukat and Wynn spend a week going through the fire caves.
Yeah.
Kai Wynn even had to catch her breath and Dukat was like complaining about it.
Yeah.
Sisko shows up in about an hour.
Yeah.
I was like, okay.
Not only that, but they spend like, what, 3 or 4 episodes or maybe more setting up like this Dukat Wynn journey that they're going to go to the fire caves and all that sort of stuff. And it's like, that was the payoff?
Yeah.
Really? Especially for a character like Dukat, as well as Wynn, actually, who are so prominent through the series and such, oh, like just irritating adversaries we want to see really have a satisfying resolution to. And it's fine.
We sound like the most vocal of Game of Thrones fans right now, Cam,
with our
complaints.
So I've heard.
Okay, so what is, in fact, your number two then?
My number two is Favor the Bold and Sacrifice of Angels.
Okay.
And this is probably the greatest story arc in Deep Space Nine, and this is the resolution to it. That's the reason I didn't put it at number one, ultimately, was that I just felt like it doesn't stand on its own in the same way the other two-parters do. So much depends on those 5 episodes that come before it. And so, like, taken as just 2 episodes, I mean, this is just, oh man, this stuff is just incredible. Like, the retaking of Deep Space Nine is just incredible drama.
Yeah.
Seeing every character play fairly significant roles, you know, like TNG two-parters often sidetracked characters left, right, and center. Voyager does it as well sometimes. And DS9 gives them all so much to do. Even the recurring characters are getting a lot to do. Everything they get to do is interesting. Even a character like Tora Ziyal gets a big, big dramatic moment that really does shatter people. I mean, this is pretty much perfect serialized sci-fi writing.
It's tough to make this one even higher up on my list, but like, I just wonder if it would have been that much stronger if instead of a two-parter, it was just like a feature-length episode, because sure, then I could criticize it less for Favor the Bold not really being able to stand on its own as an episode.
Yeah. It does ratchet up the tension, though, a lot.
It does, it does. But let's say you just saw that episode in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd just be tough to kind of sit there and be like, okay.
Yeah.
I don't get it, you know. So that's my one critique of this one that I otherwise think is just a fantastic two-part outing here.
Well, you have to come up with those critiques to justify why, you know, you put one over another. Because with DS9, and we are not going to experience this with Enterprise or Voyager, there's a lot of great two-parters, and it's tough to really come up with like an objectively great order.
Yeah.
Versus like, I think some of the other, there's Voyager episodes that are going to be easier to rank near the top than others. And I don't think fans are going to disagree with us on a lot of them.
Like, I almost feel like we could like be playing a game of Yahtzee right now and just dropping all of our little cubes onto the surface of the table, and whatever order it lands on, we'd probably be mostly satisfied.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so my number two is What You Leave Behind. Mm-hmm. I think this is just tying up loose ends for these characters. So fantastic. And I think All Good Things was just an incredibly epic adventure that ties in so thematically well with TNG. This is really what DS9 does best, though. It's very much character-based, and you are getting satisfying conclusions to the vast majority of the characters. Some are dispatched quite quickly, say Wan Wei-yun. They've got to have his DNA somewhere else in those data banks of the Dominion, right? Right?
Well, you know, I wonder if, you know, the hypothetical season 8 were to happen, if they would have worked Wei-yun back in somehow.
Yeah, I could buy that. Coming from the other side of the wormhole, though, because they did establish that the last of the Wei-yun clones was destroyed in the Alpha Quadrant. But even just something like how Damar gets martyred.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is kind of, you question kind of the shades of gray introduced to such a wretched character as he was first introduced, that becomes into a bit of a hero figure, a problematic hero figure. And I don't know, I'm sure there's so many baby Damars that were born 9 months after the fall of Cardassia at that point. So I just think that this is the way you wrap up a series that is as epic as Deep Space Nine, sure, a few things that they could have done better, but I think if you think about how they literally took like the final 10 hours of the series, had to tie a bow on everything, some things may have gotten lost in the shuffle, but this to me was just a great way to do that. Not for just the last 10 episodes, the final chapter, but for the series as a whole.
I mean, there's a real finality to this finale that TNG didn't have to have. Yeah. They had those movies going forward and they knew it. So, you know, we get a fantastic Picard story that does bookend the series, you know, all good things. But they don't have to explain, well, where's Riker going next? Where's Worf going next? They need them on that ship. You know, they need to keep the status quo going for those films. Whereas DS9 didn't have that luxury. And so we get to actually have finality and a fantastic ending because of that.
Kim, are you saying that they didn't think that 22 years later they'd get their own animated feature sort of presentation in a 2-hour long documentary that totaled about 12 minutes of
that the fans
time?
Would pay for?
Yeah, the fans would have to pay for through Indiegogo?
Yeah.
Wow, okay. Premonition right there.
It just shows you the disparity in how those shows are treated, though. Like, TNG is given, like, 4 splashy big blockbuster movies, and DS9 gets the Kickstarter documentary 20 years later.
I'll take it. It was a fantastic documentary.
That documentary is better than probably, at least in my opinion, probably the 4 TNG movies.
Yeah, yeah.
You might argue for First Contact, but I think I might probably say the documentary I liked more.
Okay, that's interesting. But, we're both at our number one. I think we have the same one, so why don't we just say it at the count of 3. 1, 2, 3.
The Way of the Warrior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cam, I just can't imagine a more epic sort of Deep Space Nine entry here. Just everything from Worf finally being able to play a smart detective, you know, to just kind of setting up the stakes and kind of reinventing Deep Space Nine once again. It seemed as if they had to do that almost every single season premiere.
Right.
But the thing is, like, it almost feels as if you could criticize it for going backwards to a certain degree and that they were kind of shuffling off the Dominion stuff, reintroducing, like, classic, quote-unquote, villains as the Klingons. Whatever comes after this and however they reshape the series moving forwards, this made me so excited to continue watching Deep Space Nine when I first caught it in first run. And I think Worf fits in so well on Deep Space Nine in a way that I think surprises a lot of people here. And you could tell, I mean, there's chemistry between him and Jadzia right off the bat where she's wearing a medieval attire.
nice hat.
I love that line. Look, the dry Worf one-liners as written by Ron Moore, always great to me. So, and I just think about the battle that we got.
Yeah.
We never, ever saw anything like this in television, you know, especially with syndicated television back in the day.
Yes.
This was just something to behold.
Like, the new armaments on DS9 were just incredible.
You know.
Yeah, and just seeing, like, Klingon presence on the ship, or on the station, was so cool to see, too. Just them interacting with other characters and seeing how, you know, these outsider characters like your Odos and your Quarks respond to them was really interesting. It just gave that whole two-parter, or that extended episode, like, a real new energy. And it just does feel like its own little mini epic.
But even like smaller moments within kind of the big stuff going on, like say Garak and Dekat fighting side by side.
Yep.
Like that's, and just them exchanging little quips at each other, you know, like that's what Deep Space Nine does so well. And I just think it's just and this is one that I think is up there in fans' esteem. Totally.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think this one is necessarily underrated by fans at all. And I think that, you know, the proof is right there on the screen.
And I'm not like a huge Klingon guy. There's lots of Klingon stories I love.
No, you're only about 5'9".
That's right. Yeah, I'm definitely not Klingon height, that's for sure. I'd be like an Alexander. I'd be like the albatross on the ship.
Like young Alexander, not the teenage Alexander.
That's why I'm wearing a cowboy hat.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, I'm not the world's biggest Klingon story fan. So like, when I get one that I like, I'll really respond to it. Especially like the TOS ones, like Errand of Mercy, for example, or Day of the Dove, like I really love. But like, I found in the Berman era, a lot of time when it came to the TNG Klingon stories, I found a lot of them were like, some worked, some didn't, but there was a little bit of a sameness sometimes. And like DS9, they didn't really want to do the Klingons. This was like a studio memo, to like bring back well-known adversaries. So many creators, when, you know, presented this sort of, you know, this order from up above, would just give you something lousy or just kind of phone it in and be like, yeah, well, we did it. You know, there you go. They somehow take this order from above and turn it into like the greatest extended episode of like Star Trek, or one of the greatest of all time. And then that whole season, they still keep it going with great Klingon stories. Like, I don't have any quibbles with DS9's Klingon stories.
No.
Yeah. Like, they're all fantastic. And, like, this is just the perfect way to start it off. And, you know, again, introducing Worf back into the series, that could be so cynical. And I'm sure a lot of the actors felt it was. And yet, when you watch that story, you want to see Worf hang around. Not because of, you know, affection for him from TNG, just because this character has clicked with this cast, and you want to see where they're going to go going forward.
Well, Cam, why don't we review our total ranks? It could be a little bit confusing. Do we want to go 10 to 1 or 1 to 10? What do you think?
10 to 1.
Okay, you start.
Okay, so my number 10 was the McKee. My number 9 was Past Tense. My number 8 was Homefront / Paradise Lost. My number 7 was Emissary. My number 6 was Improbable Cause / The Die Is Cast. Number 5, In Purgatory's Shadow and By Inferno's Light. Number 4, The Search. Number 3, What You Leave Behind. Number 2, Favor the Bold and Sacrifice of Angels. And number 1, Way of the Warrior.
And for me, my number 10 is The McKee, Parts 1 and 2. Number 9, Homefront, Paradise Lost. Number 8, Past Tense, Parts 1 and 2. Number 7, In Purgatory's Shadow and By Inferno's Light. Number 6, The Search, Parts 1 and 2. Number 5, Improbable Cause and The Die Is Cast. Number 4, Emissary. Number 3, Favor the Bold, Sacrifice of Angels. Number 2, What You Leave Behind. And number 1, The Way of a Warrior.
Very nice. Okay, and so before we wrap up, we're going to give out some awards here. When we did the films, we did like a whole episode giving out awards to the various films for things, you know, that were good and things that were bad. And we do, you know, a few less of those for the two-parters, but we've got some fun categories that we kind of want to tie this off with. And so let's start with the best performance. Who gave, you know, the most iconic performance in these two-parters, or at least the one that impacted you, or however you justify it yourself?
You know, I go back and forth a little bit between the Odo Garrick stuff going on in The Die Is Cast, and I ultimately think I have to give it to Rene Auberjonois.
Okay.
I would think maybe a couple years ago, I'd say just that magnetism that Garrick has during these scenes where he's the one doing the torturing, but you can see internally he's being tortured.
It's deep, man.
Yeah, but I think with all that gunk on top of Rene Auberjonois, that is hard to act through, and he makes it so compelling. I have to believe that out of all the two-parters, this is maybe the performance that sticks out to me the most here. What about you, Cam? Best performance?
It's tough with DS9, right? Like, when we did TNG, I found it actually kind of easy, but with DS9, they give such fantastic material to everyone that it really does make it tough to narrow down. So I ultimately am going with someone who's not even a regular cast member. I'm going with a recurring cast member, and that's Mark Alaimo in Favor of the Bold and Sacrifice of Angels. Because the undoing, you know, the shattering of Dukat in the final part of that two-parter is just incredible stuff, with the death of Zial, the breakdown of Dukat. This is a villain that isn't just like a boo-hiss villain. He's a villain who we are completely just wrapped around. Like, we want to see this character's evolution. He has us with us every step of the way through that series. And I feel like this really was Mark Alaimo's like home run type moment, where it was like, I'm going to take everything I built up over all these seasons and just give Dukat this big finale. Now we got more coming. You know, Walt is a really good second finale.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the Fire Cave stuff I already talked about. Yeah. But I feel like in Sacrifice of Angels, this is his big moment. And I feel like he knew it too. Like, it would not surprise me if Mark Alaimo in this moment thought this might be his final episode of Deep Space Nine.
Sure. I could buy that as well.
Yeah.
Okay, Ham, what's the next category?
Okay, so we're going to go to Best Guest Star, which was interesting. Tyler, who did you pick?
I picked Mark Alaimo for pretty much all the reasons you laid out right there, though. And to me, it was the Sacrifice of Angels performance, where he just crumbles, you know, under seeing just utter defeat, utter humiliation, and then the loss of his daughter. It's tough to tell how much a complete sociopath truly cares about the daughter as an entity, or a daughter as more of an appendage of his own identity.
Right.
So, look, it's not like it has to have special guest star Mark Alaimo for me to just absolutely be enthralled by this. There's one other character, or actor, I should say, that was up there for me. I don't know if you picked this one, so I won't spoil it, but you go for it, sir.
Okay, so for me, I actually tried, I didn't want to give it to someone who was like a recurring character on DS9. Not because there's anything wrong with their performances, just because when I looked at, you know, our previous episode that we did on TNG two-parters, you know, we kind of were like, well, we're not going to maybe give it to John Delancey just because he does a lot of Q episodes. And we ended up going with, like, Elizabeth Dennehy, for example, for Best of Both Worlds. And so, like, I wanted to give it to someone who only shows up a little bit, which in DS9 is actually tough.
Sure.
Because yeah. A lot of the characters do come back a lot. So I ended up going with Paul Dooley as Enebrin Tain.
Yeah, that's actually the one that I was going to say as well as my very close runner-up there.
Because when you have Garak, and Dukat for that matter, who are these hugely charismatic Cardassian characters, to introduce the guy who's, like, more Garak than Garak.
Sure.
That's tough. Like, and a lot of actors wouldn't necessarily be up to the task, or you'd walk away being like, well, okay, I guess, you know, whatever. But I felt like Paul Dooley brought so much to this character, so much ambiguity, so much, oh, just all the stuff about like how brutal he was on Garak through his whole life. And you walk away still having some sort of sense of understanding of this character and where he's coming from. Which I think it would be so easy to paint this character as a one-note villain.
Yeah, no, totally.
He could have totally been that dude in Gambit.
Bran.
Yes.
Does it amaze you that I can remember the name?
Yeah, it does, actually.
Yeah, of that dud of a villain.
I've looked it up so many times.
And you keep forgetting.
Yep, every time.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the worst guest star.
Okay. I was alluding to it at the top with the name dropping of Admiral Todman, but the thing is, he's mostly just a joke to us. Like, there's nothing wrong with the actor's performance. The one that I kind of wince at whenever I see it is from Paradise Lost, where we have the Red Squad cadet get totally schooled by Sisko, and he's like, "Oi, Jillicky, sir, I tells ya. We was ordered to do it. I swears."
He's from the cast of Oliver.
I was thinking, you know, one of the Bowery boys. But, sure. You know, so I was just like, all due respect to that actor, I just don't know what kind of direction he was getting.
He's standing opposite Avery Brooks.
I know. It's tough. It's tough.
Yeah.
But it just was when I was reminded that we had to do these categories, that was the one that just sprang to mind.
Right,
so I was
right.
Like, okay, I've got to give it to this one. But what stands out to you, sir?
It's funny. You said that sprang to your mind. This one sprang to my mind immediately. And that's Herschel Sparber as President Jerish Inyo in Homefront / Paradise Lost.
I kind of liked him.
This character is just, it's almost more for the character than the performance.
That's what I was going to ask.
Really.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, the character is just
the
so
most milquetoast, like forgettable, bland character. And maybe it's because we had Kurtwood Smith as the president of the Federation in the Star Trek VI, the film, and he's so great. And this character just drove us nuts. I remember when we watched this, we're like, this guy is so feckless. You know, I'm sure like the actor's fine, but just in terms of this character, I was like, boy, what a wet noodle of a character.
And we never saw him again.
No, we did not.
Would it be amazing if he's brought back for the Star Trek Picard spinoff?
As the number one co-star. He's number one.
That'd be fantastic. I'd watch the hell out of that.
Okay, so let's go to action sequences. Let's talk about the best action sequence.
I go back and forth. You might feel the same way here, but there's a couple other contenders that may get overlooked. Maybe one of those would be the big destruction of the combined Obsidian Order Tal Shiar fleet in the Dai's Cast and in I always get these mixed up, but whatever the Dai's Cast is.
Yeah.
You know, but I can't quite give it to that because I think Deep Space Nine kind of upped the ante in episodes that followed there. And the one that I ultimately got to go back to is Way of the Warrior, just kind of that first battle of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Just watching those photon torpedoes hit the Klingon ships going at it, and you also have it intercut with, you know, a Klingon invasion force, you know, phasers of firing. To me, this is how you do an action sequence on Star Trek, which had not always, up until, say, Discovery, I don't think it always had a great reputation of doing action sequences spectacularly well.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. That is a fantastic one. I definitely considered that one strongly. The one I ended up going with is the punching through the enemy lines, the Dominion lines, in Sacrifice of Angels.
That was the other one that
oh my God, the Klingon ships behind them.
Oh, yeah.
Like, oh, it's so incredible. And like, when I that one really did jump to my mind as soon as I started brainstorming, you know, what I thought the best action sequence was. And I was like, is this because of that documentary? like, you know, that DS9 documentary, we get to see that. They really hype it up. And I'm like, is it just because of that? Seeing it on the big screen, seeing it in HD. Maybe I'm being unfair because the other action scenes didn't have that advantage for me, especially the recency of having seen it. So I sat on YouTube and I watched a bunch of the other ones I was considering. And I watched the crappiest low-grade rip of this action sequence. Yeah. It was in mono audio through one speaker. It was pixelated. And I still got chills watching it.
Sure.
And I said, okay, it's not just the HD treatment on the big screen. This scene is incredible.
I feel bad for people that we'll never get to see this on the big screen. Like,
yeah.
You and I were very, very lucky that there were a few screenings of the documentary here in town, and we got to see it, and it was just mesmerizing to catch.
Yeah, you know? Totally.
So, Cam, is that it, or is there another category
left?
No,
we've got the worst action sequence.
Oh, okay.
So what was yours?
Cam, you alluded to it earlier on in this, but those bell riots in past tense, it just, like, it was just so bland. It was a lot of shotgun pumping. And unfortunately, there was this actress who is up for Worst Performance Award as well. But remember that actress where they storm the building and she just starts screaming and flailing?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and I'm just like, it was not a very effective way to ratchet up the tension at all.
Yeah.
They kept, like, throwing benches in front of a door. You were supposed to care. It was not a great climax when, I guess, the police forces invaded this little administrative office within the sanctuary.
Right. Yeah, definitely didn't have the energy of some of the great action sequences on DS9, that's for sure.
It didn't give you chills.
No, it
watching it pixelated.
It shuddered.
Yeah.
No, for me, the worst, I picked the imposter Bashir in that whole sequence where they're slingshotting it.
Yeah.
And, like, here's the thing. As an action sequence, you're kind of like, you know, is it really the worst? It's really weak. And, like, I went back and rewatched it because my memory was that it was really poor. And I thought, you know what? Maybe it was just the experience I had watching it that one time. And I sat and watched it on YouTube as well. And it's so goofily directed. Like, yeah. There's this really weird zoom in on Bashir's face where he's like, what?
Like, wasn't he watching, like, the sun or, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And it's just... like he's being grabbed by the, Defiant. And it's just like, what? And then it's this, like, really dorky looking shot of the Defiant, like, just tossing this ship. And it's the sort of thing, maybe in season 7 they could have pulled off and made it look cool, but it just does not look cool at this point in time in the show's run. So that's the one I went with. Because that's their big impact moment for the show, too. Like, that's the finale of that two-parter.
They should have just left it on the asteroid prison. Like, that would have been where the climax should have really been. And I think for me, the emotional climax was, at least.
Or at least just shoot it, like, Balance of Terror style, where you don't have to rely on the effects to deliver the punch, which, in this case, the effects weren't up to snuff.
I rely on Worf to deliver punches to Jem'Hadar soldiers in this episode.
And so now for our final award, it's the Why Is This a Two-Parter Award, which is maybe tougher with DS9 than the other series. But Tyler, what did you pick?
So I look at what all these two-parters added to the overall mythology of Deep Space Nine, and I think the one that I liked but was a little bit superfluous was Past Tense Parts 1 and 2. It just...
Yeah.
Like, there's a great story. I urge everyone to rewatch it if they think that I'm a little out there for, you know, talking about how great it is. But it's one that you could skip on over, and you won't miss out on any of the epic mythology going on throughout the series. What about you, sir?
That was mine as well. Yeah. I really did consider the Maquis, but then I'm like, well, it is setting up a lot, and there's a lot of cool stuff, you know, throughout. Especially, like, you know, you get the kidnapping of Gul Dukat, that very much features prominently in the second part. That's a lot to condense into one episode. Whereas, like, Past Tense, I think you could have condensed it. You would lose the stuff probably with Jadzia and that dorky guy, which no one would cry over. You'd probably get a few less shotgun pumping moments. But I do wonder, and I guess they probably made this a two-parter because it was expensive to have that whole backlot set.
Sure.
So you want to get your money's worth, kind of like Time's Arrow. But, it is something that I do wonder if fans might like it more if it was an hour. Like, it's a lot to spend 2 hours in this very depressing setting, whereas maybe 1 hour, it clicks a little more. Like, when you look at an episode, you know, like, say, Far Beyond the Stars, which is an amazing episode, it's 1 hour.
Yeah.
And it's tackling a lot and it pulls it all off. And I really do think Past Tense probably could have done a similarly intense and powerful one-hour version of this story. So, I don't know.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, we'll never know. But we got what we got, and it's still pretty good. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Let us know your rankings on the DS9 two-parters, and let us know if you agree with us or have your own awards that you'd like to give out. Okay, so Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Cam, we've been doing this for years and years, but around this time of year, we always tackle the current state of Star Trek. I remember the first time we tackled it, things weren't looking so great.
There's some new merch coming.
Yeah, you know, I hear that Roberto Orci might be directing the next film in the Kelvinverse. But now,
yeah,
it is just coming out, being pumped out like a factory. We've got so much to tackle with regards to where the franchise is right now, where it's looking forward to in the future, and not the long term, but the near term as well. This is always one of our favorite episodes to do every single year. I urge everyone to give it a listen if they just want to get our thoughts on where we think the franchise is in comparison to where it was, you know, just over the last 50-some years.
Cool. Okay, so you can, of course, find us on Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in VFX on the big screen, Smith.
Nice. You can find me at Reportin. That's REP. P as in Purgatory Shadow. ORTON.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.